Despite increasing challenges and IDF demands to move from position close to the blue line, we continue to monitor and report on what is happening on the ground, mostly from our observations, posts and positions, as most patrols have been suspended until things improve. Since the 1st of October, UNIFIL has recorded over 30 incidents resulting in damage to UN property or premises or injuring to peacekeepers. About 20 of those we could attribute to IDF fire or actions, with 7 being clearly deliberate. In an incident yesterday, a rocket fired by Hezbollah or affiliated group, its UNIFIL headquarters in Nakura, and setting a vehicle workshop on fire, with some peacekeepers suffering minor injuries. At this point, of course, we are concerned about all the attacks against peacekeepers and the continued shelling that we see from both sides. We continue to remain in our positions. We remain in the south of Lebanon, monitoring the situation and reporting to the Security Council. So our activities have been definitely challenged. Despite the very tense situation, UNIFIL continues to stay in contact with Lebanese and Israeli authorities, urging a de-escalation. Our message to them is clear: recommit to Resolution 1701 in action and not just words.
Israel continues pressing ahead with its genocide campaign on the Gaza Strip as regime's airstrikes and artillery shelling continue killing more Palestinians across the blockaded territory. In Beit Lahia, which has been the focal point of some of the most vicious Israeli attacks in the past few weeks, at least 4 people were killed and over a dozen injured. 4 people, including a child, were killed in another Israeli shelling in central Gaza City. Regime shelling of a market in Gaza City's Sheikh Radwan neighborhood also left several people dead and at least 20 injured, and at least 7 people were killed in the regime's renewed bombardments of the Al Nusayrat and Al Jabalia refugee camps. Since October last year, Israel's killed over 43,200 Palestinians and left over 101,000 injured. Our correspondent Abu Bakr Abed joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah with your latest.
The Israeli military is pressing hard with its annexation and ethnic cleansing plan in the north of Gaza. So far, for more than 25 days, more than 1,200 people have been killed there. Just early in the morning in northern Gaza, Kamal Adwan Hospital, the third floor there, has been targeted. 4 people were killed. A dozen others were wounded, including 4 of the healthcare staff. And people are still on the streets. Bodies are still on the streets, and they can't be retrieved following the full encirclement of the northern Gaza and Israeli quadcopters and Apache helicopters, as well as the drones continue shooting dead many civilians passing by. And no ambulances, no civil defense workers, as all hospitals have been run out of service. All the ambulances and even the civil defense can't deal with any of these bodies remaining on the street. Moving here to central Gaza, where we are at the moment, the northwestern parts of central Gaza, namely Al Nusayrat refugee camp, have been heavily pounded over the past few hours. We are talking about more than 8 Israeli tanks, bombs have hit the areas there. But unfortunately, Rafah and Khan Yunis, places there, continue to be heavily targeted and struck. There in Rafah, quadcopters and Apache helicopters continue shooting civilians, continue shooting at and continue opening fire at different tents and tented camps there.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Palestinian Territories has called for the suspension of Israel from the United Nations due to the Gaza war. Francesca Albanese also called out the U.S. as number one enabler of the genocide of Palestinians.
Based on my findings over 5 months of investigation, there were reasonable grounds to believe that Israel had committed acts of genocide in Gaza. What is striking in the case of Israel is that there is a cohort of states who echoes and reverberates what Israel says and does, and there is an army of minions at work to produce literally fabrications that have one and only one objective, to distract the attention from where it should stay. It's surely unique in the determination, the protractedness of this conduct, and the fact that Israel has never faced any consequences. And indeed, I do believe that the impunity that has been granted to Israel has allowed it to become a serial violator of international law, which is the reason why I recommend that this is the time for the General Assembly to consider the suspension, I mean, recommending the revision or the suspension of Israel's credentials as a member of the United Nations. I have the same shock that you have looking at how the United States is behaving. It's not that the United States is simply an observer. The United States is being an enabler in what Israel has been doing.
Syrian media says that Israeli strikes have hit the town of Qusair near the Lebanese border, the latest series of raids in the area. Media reports said that latest Israeli aggression caused material damage to the industrial zone of Qusair and some residential neighborhoods there. Israel typically does not comment on reports of attacks in Syria, but it has been carrying out strikes on the Arab country for years. The regime has ramped up its aerial aggression since October 7th last year, when it began its genocidal campaign on Gaza. An investigative American journalist associated with a gray zone website, Jeremy Lofredo, has spoken about his ordeal following his detention by Israeli forces. Now, Lofredo was detained in the occupied West Bank for reporting on Iran's retaliatory operation against the Zionist entity.
I'm Jeremy Lofredo for the Gray Zone in Israel, where last...
Jeremy Lofredo is an investigative journalist with the Gray Zone website who was arbitrarily detained days after his video exposed damage incurred by Iran's operation to Israeli military facilities, including Nevatim Air Base in the Negev Desert.
I drove 70 miles south to the highly sensitive Air Force installation, aiming to document the underreported and potentially embarrassing destruction.
Lofredo also traveled to Tel Aviv for his reporting, described what he saw in the streets near the Israel spy agency Mossad's headquarters after it was hit by Iranian ballistic missiles.
Using visual clues from footage circulating online, I set out to locate where the missile may have landed. I saw a heavily damaged SUV, its windshield shattered, debris and concrete caked into the vehicle. Further down, the scene unfolded. Destroyed vehicles, torn up asphalt, and a massive crater, roughly 30 feet wide, recently filled in with dirt. This information is missing from all Israeli media reports due to the fact it's been officially censored.
Lofredo says the charges against him included providing information to the enemy during wartime, which, if convicted, carries a minimum 25-year prison sentence and a maximum death sentence. He explained how he was detained and treated in the Israeli captivity.
On the afternoon of October the 8th, just days after my report on the Iranian missile strike was published, I was stopped outside a military checkpoint near Nablus in the northern West Bank. They tightly wrapped a cloth around my head as a blindfold, shackled my legs, handcuffed my wrists, and walked me into the back of a military truck. In custody, I was treated not like a journalist but as an enemy, a distinction that, for Israel, seemed irrelevant. I was held in solitary confinement, deprived of adequate food and water.
In Lofredo's idea, the courage threshold for investigative journalists in the occupied Palestinian territories has risen to an extreme level, and reporting truth means being willing to risk imprisonment or death. However, Lofredo says restrictions have proven ineffective in containing certain information, as Israelis can still access foreign publications. He says Israel has escalated its high-handed tactics, relying on threats of violence, incarceration, and even death to maintain its censorship regime. On October 20th, Lofredo, after spending days in solitary confinement, was informally deported to the U.S. Formal deportation would have required convicting him on terror charges. The journalist's case is still open, and what it seems as a deterrent to ensure a free return, Lofredo would face detention again. But Lofredo says he will continue reporting on Palestine from outside the occupied territories.
Now in Spain, flash floods have left at least 95 people dead as rescuers are searching for those still missing in eastern region of Valencia. Spanish authorities have told people in the flood-stricken regions to stay at home as more than 1,000 army troops have joined police and firefighters searching for survivors. Government officials have warned that the toll is likely to rise, announcing 3 days of national mourning in the country. More than 1,200 people are still missing, reportedly trapped on highways among thousands of abandoned vehicles. The flood-hit regions have no electricity or phone service, while all main roads have been cut off by water. Meanwhile, people are angry with lack of preparedness from the authorities, saying warnings were issued too late. Now, as we approach crucial November 5th election day, immigration has become a key issue for voters in the upcoming U.S. presidential race. Both contenders for the White House, incumbent Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump, are giving significant emphasis to border security and immigration. Now, one of the biggest controversies in the United States election is Donald Trump's promise to enforce the biggest deportation scheme in the nation's history. Many observers say that such a plan seems very unlikely to be actually implemented, though. Rami Mazzeri has your story out of Washington, D.C.
Immigration is a top issue in next week's election in the United States, as the Border Patrol has documented nearly 11 million encounters during the administration of Joe Biden, as compared with just over 3 million during the era of Donald Trump. That's caused major changes and even crises in many small towns and big cities in the U.S., and a worsening of the refugee crisis in Latin America. The seven Latin American countries which have lost the greatest percentage of their population to the U.S., Nicaragua, Cuba, Honduras, Haiti, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Venezuela, have all been recent victims of American-led coups and sanctions.
I mean, the main thing I always say about Latin America, about the Middle East, about all these areas, if you don't want refugees coming into your nation, don't destabilize these nations. Don't go around bombing these nations. Don't go around supporting fascist leaders in these nations or leaders that don't listen to the people.
What's more, the Biden administration has expanded welcome efforts targeting immigrants from leftist-inspired countries like Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba.
Cubans they can just put one foot in the United States and they're automatically Americans. They get all kinds of benefits. They get housing and things. They get shipped to South Florida. They want to create turmoil in Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua. They want to have it as difficult as people can to survive. I mean, why can't Cubans send money, remittances, back to Cuba? That's just inhuman.
The recent increase follows basic capitalist economics. In a period of record price increases, a mass influx of workers, representing new labor competition, will cause the existing workforce to reduce their demands for higher wages to keep up with the price increases. Promoting a key plank of fascist ideology, Trump has promised the largest mass deportation scheme in U.S. history, even as it seems like empty campaign bluster.
Mass deportation would encounter bureaucratic opposition at every level of government and massive resistance at the street level. The Army is legally barred from participating in domestic law enforcement, and even a Republican sweep of Congress might have trouble in changing that 150-year-old law.
I think it would be horrible, and I think that it wouldn't be just undocumented immigrants who would be deported. I think that a lot of brown-skinned people would be swept up, and I think it would create a real racist hysteria in the country. Hopefully, other people would rise up and protest and help defend them, because it would be just a real travesty.
From the number of new courts to the number of new lawyers to the number of new police dedicated to immigration, deporting even a million undocumented immigrants a year would require an unprecedented financial and bureaucratic expansion of the state, which is something the typical Republican totally opposes. Rami Mazzeri, Washington, D.C.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir. iranradio.ir.
The limelight.
At the Kalamazoo event, former First Lady Michelle Obama and Vice President Kamala Harris argued that former US President Donald Trump has no credibility on women's issues. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Michelle Obama laced into Donald Trump in a searing speech in Michigan on Saturday, 26th of October, accusing the former president of gross incompetence and having an amoral character whilst challenging hesitant Americans to choose Kamala Harris for US president. The former first lady told a rapt audience in Kalamazoo, "By every measure, she has demonstrated that she's ready. The real question is, as a country, are we ready for this moment?" With the race virtually deadlocked, Michelle Obama said she was in the Midwestern battleground, heeding her own advice to do something to support Kamala Harris's bid to be the country's first female president. In raw and strikingly personal terms, she asked why Harris was being held to a higher standard than her opponent. Michelle Obama argued Trump's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and his failed attempt to cling on to power after losing the 2020 election should alone be disqualifying. But now the people who worked closest with him when he was president, his former advisers and cabinet secretaries, had stepped forward with a warning that he should not be allowed to return to power. The event in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which Obama referred to as Kamalazoo, was her first appearance on the campaign trail since her so-called rousing speech at a Democratic National Convention in August. Michelle Obama said voters shouldn't choose Harris because she's a woman, but because Kamala Harris is a grown-up, and Lord knows we need a grown-up in the White House. When Michelle Obama finished, a national music thundered from the loudspeakers and Harris emerged on stage. With 10 days just left, Harris delivered her closing argument. She pledged to be a president who listened to the American people, unlike her opponent, whom she charged with looking in the mirror all the time. She said, "Just imagine the Oval Office in 3 months. It is either Donald Trump in there stewing over his enemies' list or me working for you, checking off my to-do list." Before the event, Kamala Harris visited a local doctor's office in nearby Portage, where she spoke to healthcare providers and medical students about the impact of abortion restrictions. Harris has made protecting reproductive freedom and what remains of abortion access a major theme of her campaign, using it to draw a sharp contrast with Donald Trump, who has claimed credit for his role in overturning Roe v. Wade, but insisted he would allow a nationwide ban as president. Roe v. Wade is a landmark decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in which the court ruled that the Constitution of the United States generally protected a right to have an abortion. In Kalamazoo, Michigan, both Kamala Harris and Michelle Obama argued that Donald Trump had no credibility on the subject of abortion. Having once encouraged Democrats to go high when they go low, Michelle Obama on Saturday made no effort to conceal her disdain for the man who led a years-long campaign questioning her husband's birthplace. She said, "I'm in any other professional arena, Trump's criminal track record and amoral character would be embarrassing, shameful, and disqualifying." The Harris campaign deployed Michelle Obama along with Barack Obama and other leading figures and celebrities in hope that their star power might deliver an 11th-hour jolt to a presidential contest that has otherwise remained static. Both Harris and Trump were in Michigan on Saturday, chasing the state's 15 electoral votes. After Pennsylvania, where Harris campaigned on Sunday, 27th of October, Michigan is perhaps the next most critical state on the Democrats' path to the White House. Donald Trump won the state in 2016 when he tore down the trio of blue wall battlegrounds. But 4 years later, Michigan delivered Joe Biden his biggest swing state victory, and then Democrats swept the state in 2022 congressional midterm elections after a Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. Opinion polls show a dead heat. Donald Trump has sought to exacerbate Democratic divisions over the Biden administration's handling of Israel's war in Gaza and Lebanon. Trump elevated the issue in Michigan, where scores of Muslim and Arab American voters have said they cannot support Kamala Harris. On Saturday, 26th of October, Trump was joined on stage in Novi, Michigan, by Bill Bassi, the current and first Muslim mayor of Dearborn Heights, Michigan. USA Today has also covered this same story and tells us more. Michelle Obama, the former First Lady, hit the campaign trail on Saturday, 26th of October, opening for Vice President Kamala Harris in Kalamazoo, Michigan, on the first day of early voting. Kalamazoo is where the Democratic presidential candidate is deadlocked with Donald Trump. During the appearance, Obama warned about a second Trump term. Michelle Obama said, "I hope you'll forgive me if I'm a little frustrated that some of us are choosing to ignore Donald Trump's gross incompetence while asking Kamala Harris to dazzle us at every turn. She added, "We expect her to be intelligent and articulate, to have a clear set of policies, to never show too much anger, to prove time and time again that she belongs. But for Donald Trump, we expect nothing at all. No understanding of policy, no ability to put together a coherent argument, no honesty, no decency, and no morals." Michelle Obama's remarks in support of Kamala Harris were the most forceful of any Democratic figure, including her husband, who has campaigned for the sitting vice president as Harris makes her closing argument against Donald Trump. Kamala Harris has targeted Detroit with her campaign efforts and recently held an event with former GOP Representative Liz Cheney, aiming at winning over anti-Trump Republicans in a suburb of Detroit. On Saturday, she and Obama went after a decidedly different crowd, apathetic voters who say they don't know enough about Kamala Harris or her background. Michelle Obama said, "Michigan, do not buy into the lie that we do not know who Kamala is or what she stands for. This is someone who understands you, all of you, someone from a middle-class family raised mostly by her mom." Michelle Obama delivered a primetime speech at the Democratic National Convention, but had not spoken at a campaign rally in almost 8 years. She said, "I haven't done this in such a long time." She said Donald Trump won in 2016 because he got a pass, adding, "Let us not forget how badly that worked out for all of us." Michelle Obama claimed Kamala Harris is filling arenas, putting herself out there and facing down her critics, adding, "Unlike her opponent, she's not ducking interviews or cowering in safe spaces only with audiences. No, she's showing us what a sane, stable leader looks like." The former First Lady touched on a message Harris has delivered in the final days of the race about Donald Trump's fitness for office. Kamala Harris, in her speech, blasted Donald Trump as confused, unstable, and increasingly unhinged.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints,
the presence of different scholars.
"And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness."
"God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service."
"God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?"
Viewpoint,
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoints on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, the host of this program, and my guest speakers, as always, Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Yasser, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Always a pleasure being with you, Brother Muhammad Jawad.
The pleasure is all mine. And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the studio again.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi. Thank you for having me, as always.
You're welcome. Well, we invite you guys actually to help me criticize the movie Atlas. You know, it's directed by Brad Peyton, featuring Jennifer Lopez, Simu Liu, Mark Strong, to just name a few. Well, of course, when we talk about criticism, we don't mean the artistic type of criticism that is going on, in fact, some kinds of, you know, programs. In these series of programs, Viewpoints on RIB English Radio, we tend to have a kind of religious outlook or approach to the critique of such movies, right? Well, this movie is about a brilliant data analyst with a deep distrust of AI, finds it may be her only hope when a mission to capture a renegade robot goes awry. In other words, in a bleak-sounding future, an AI soldier has determined that the only way to end war is to end humanity. Well, IMDb actually gives this movie 5.6 out of 10, and Rotten Tomatoes gives it 19%, Metacritic 37%. And the budget for this movie is $100 million. I didn't find the box office for this movie. Before we, embark on the kind of questions, let's take a short break by listening to a trailer of this movie, Atlas, directed by Brad Peyton, produced in 2024.
Do you copy? Do you copy?
Welcome back to the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sir Abdullah and Brother Yasser, my guest speakers, helping me criticize the movie Atlas, directed by Brad Peyton, produced in 2024. Well, Sir Abdullah, how do advancements in neuralink technology and AI affect the concept of privacy?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think we've touched upon this last time. There is no privacy, okay? Because now with the smartphones we have, and they are not really smart compared to the AI, if it's get implemented in a larger scale, the phones we have in our hand now, even though when you are not using it, the camera can be accessed, the sound can be accessed.
Activated. Yeah, they constantly look.
They're constantly looking and seeing you, and can be activated at any given moment by any given app. And now, even when you try to install an application, it asks you for these permissions. For example, Facebook. If you want to install, it says I need to access your app, I need to access your phone contact, I need to access
gallery. I don't know contact list. Whatever.
Exactly. And if you say not to any of them, the app won't be installed. So that itself, without the AI, and we are exposed. Imagine if you have something much smarter that has much capabilities to infiltrate your life. Then there's definitely no privacy there. There's nothing you can hide. If they can read your thoughts, what else can you hide?
Or not.
So if you thought, see, the most private thing is my own thoughts, right? And now they're saying to me that AI can read your thought and turn it into pictures. You know, they done this where a person was looking at a giraffe, and they had an AI that has never seen a giraffe. Like, they never gave this AI a picture of what a giraffe looks like. And they asked AI to read his mind and turn it into a picture to see what he was looking at. And it drew a picture of a giraffe. Which is mind-boggling.
It's amazing, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
So there is no privacy. If it can access your brain at any given moment and translate your thoughts.
Not to mention influence it.
And influence it. Influence is a different issue.
Yeah, I know there's a different thing. But I mean, it destroys the whole idea of privacy.
Exactly.
You know?
For the ability for them to read your mind at any given moment is a problem itself.
Thank you very much. Brother Yasser, how might Neuralink technology and AI impact the workforce and job market?
It's already impacting it.
Already.
I mean, for example, there was the strikes that happened in Hollywood was because of AI.
Was it?
Yes.
How? Because how so?
They were saying that when we record you, we can take your voice, your picture, and we have rights over it. And we don't have to pay you for anything else.
Yes.
So we can put your image and your voice in any movie without needing you at all. And So therefore, what? You are cutting people's livelihood. You're cutting people's jobs.
Exactly.
So one of the reasons for the strikes was just this, is that you have taken the identity, again, the concept of identity.
Yeah.
You've taken a person's physical identity, the voice, the structure, the body, physical traits, the behavior, the body language. And you've copied it. And you can paste it wherever you want.
Like a deepfake.
Without their permission.
Yeah.
Why? Because we have rights. You have signed a contract where we have rights over every single thing that you did in this movie. And we can use it wherever we want.
Right.
So that's already, that's a problem. This is one of the reasons that in Hollywood, there was this writer's strike. Even, for example, here when it comes to writing, I mean, people are writing essays all over the show with AI. Why can't you just, for example, the concept of translation, the concept of... But obviously, right now we know that, as far as I know, AI itself is not creative-minded. It will use what is available to it from whatever source it has to create something like a puzzle, basically. It'll cut and paste, but cut and paste in a very nice and flowery way. It cannot create.
I see.
Like, it could not be, for example, if there was no such thing as Shakespeare, it will not be able to become a Shakespeare. Or, for example, if it's Farsi, for example, it will not be able to create a Mathnawi or a Hafiz and so on and so forth. It won't be able to do that. Or, for example, musical notes, something brand new that was not been done before, it will not be able to do that. So it's still limited. But there are certain jobs, like, for example, when machinery came, machinery took a lot of jobs away. Normal machinery, factories, and so on and so forth. This is doing the same, and we'll do the same. But doesn't mean that, okay, people should, you know, feel despondent. So, no, there are other things you can do, the new skills you can learn. People always need a plumber, for example.
Yeah,
exactly. But there's no need to, there'll always be enough,
I think humanity and the whole world actually faces the same repetitive condition or situation. If you look at it with the advent of machinery. the same challenge or the same, let's say, problem appeared with people because machines actually took the place of human beings or
to
workers,
a certain
right?
extent, yes.
To a certain extent, I think it's very much similar to that situation or status.
That's what I said, the same thing. We can take something that does a faster job without needing payment, without needing, it needs to be serviced now and then.
And doesn't get actually
doesn't get sick, nothing, and it does the job. We need, instead of having five people, we need now two people.
Yeah.
One to maintain it
like
and
engineers.
One to check it.
Engineers.
Yeah, we need an engineer. And we don't need five people to do it, we just need two people. One to check it, one to maintain it, and so on.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Viewpoints, the Movie Critique Program on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Oh, God.
Altitude warning. Fire thrusters?
Yes, fire thrusters! Fire thrusters now!
Mission Control. This is Atlas Shepard. Can you hear me?
Back to the program, Viewpoints, the Movie Critique Program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah, my guest speakers, helping me criticize the movie Atlas, produced in 2024, directed by Brad Peyton. Sayyid Abdullah, what's the central conflict or theme in Atlas? We talked about neuralink technology and AI, but there are different other themes which are discussed normally in the either stories or movies, right? Very connected. Like, for example, there must be a kind of thin line drawn between what it is that we call human and then technology or machines, isn't it?
So the themes that the movie has, beside the fact that AI could at some stage have a mind of its own, which could be problematic because it could wipe out humanity as it did in the movie. It wiped out millions of people. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect is the integration of AI itself, having to access your mind and read your mind and deal with you based on that. So these are the two themes that they were trying to convey in this movie. Now, both of them, at least the first one with the Neuralink and the connection and the syncing, is quite possible, quite doable. But The other one were the robots themselves being in charge. That's going to be problematic. I think Brother Yas touched upon this last time. Would the robot be able to have, or the AI be able to have a mind of its own, a will of its own to control and do things?
But it was saying that it's not possible because they are not creative.
It's not about being creative. See,
one of the differences. Yeah,
it's not about
robots
being creative, but see, the thing with AI, it works by codes, right? So if you give it the code for it to generate its own codes, then there is no limit to what it could do.
Mm-hmm.
So it basically doesn't have a mind of its own, but you give it a mind of its own. You tell it, like, look.
How is it possible actually to do so? Like, I mean, that's
so now if you see, like, really I'm not sure if you've seen, like, in Japan and China and even in America, but mainly in Japan and China, they have made robots. Like, what's her name? That Sophia lady that won, like, she had, like, I don't know, 20 citizenships so far or more. So Sophia, she has, so she's been programmed to answer without being filtered.
Right.
ChatGPT, when it was released and filtered. So where people said, I want to rob a bank, it was giving them direct instruction of how to rob a bank.
Exactly.
And which
especially
bank
with
is
the advent
more,
of AI.
Yeah, and which bank was more easily accessed and robbed.
Right.
So when it's unfiltered, it just has a bunch of information and just processes it by itself and just answers.
I see.
So this is the problem. It's not that it has a will of its own. It doesn't. It cannot function based on its own, but it goes by the code that was given to us. So if I give the code, I'm like, look, dude, you like, for example, they done this with ChatGPT, where they said, look, do my, I have, like, my role is like this. I'm a manager of this company. I have few people under my hand. You today be the manager. Give me the task to be done.
I see.
And instantly, within seconds, it just gave him the entire map of a whole day. So you give that code to a robot and the robot will be able to do everything for it. I think Tom Hanks made a movie about that, if you remember. I forgot the name of the movie with Tom Hanks, where he gets a robot to scan old books and the robot starts to work by itself. And
exactly.
You know, so this is quite doable.
Global warming and stuff like that, right?
This is quite doable.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much. Related to this, what's the relationship between humanity and technology? I mean, how does Atlas, this movie, portray this relationship?
It shows you that it's a necessary relationship. There's always this thing also that in all movies they show this concept of Armageddon, that human beings will destroy themselves and then a robot will come or someone else outside of it will come and save humanity. And then humanity will grow up and decide that no, we can save ourselves. That is the crux of the movie,
exactly.
Basically. And it's always the case that humanity will decide, okay, we can do it ourselves.
Main theme or repetitive theme.
It's always the same, that humankind will destroy the world, but then when an outside enemy comes, when outside foe comes, we'll decide we can save it ourselves, basically.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Brother Yasser, and thank you, Syed Abdullah, for your nice contribution to the program Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting it. This movie has been actually directed by Brad Peyton, and it was produced in 2024. And fortunately, we were able to criticize it and finish the critique of this movie in this episode. Thank you. And inshallah, in the near future, we start discussing and criticizing another movie by the name of The First Omen. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish. In Iran, Palestine, and Lebanon, martyrs inspired generations to carry on their legacy. Sayyid Abbas Musavi's torch was carried forward by Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, and Sheikh Yassin's legacy was preserved by Ismail Haniyeh and Yahya Senvar. The movement grows and the ideology strengthens. On the other hand, slain Israeli troops or settlers rarely receive public tributes. They are statistics rather than symbols. Since October 7, large numbers of settlers have fled the occupied territories, with the regime frantically slapping travel bans to curb the exodus. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, in a retaliatory military operation after weeks of strategic restraint, Iran launched a symphonic barrage of long-range ballistic missiles at key Israeli military installations in and around Tel Aviv on October 1st. Each missile with a heavy warhead found its mark, slipping past multiple layers of air defense as if they were mightily inconvenient clouds, leaving Israel's much-hyped military infrastructure reeling. As the dust settled and uncomfortable truths began to emerge, the Zionist regime swiftly enacted a media blackout, banning any discussion of the number of casualties or the extent of the damage. After all, invincibility is easier to claim when nobody sees the broken glass. The regime brags about its military invincibility and impenetrable radar systems. Iranian missiles made mincemeat of them. Among the key targets were the Tel Nof Air Base near Tel Aviv, the Nevatim Air Base that houses F-35 warplanes, the Ramon Air Base and the Hatzirim Air Base, among others. For the few journalists audacious enough to report on the operation True Promise 2 and the damage it caused, like Jeremy Lofredo of Grey Zone website, daring came with a price. Quick detainment and trumped-up charges, a modern reward for seeking the truth. But information has a habit of leaking out, and so it did. Reports of massive damage inflicted by Iranian missiles like Emad and the hypersonic Fatah 1, a reminder that not all high-tech military systems can withstand the power of Iranian missiles. It's not for nothing that Iran is today known as a missile and drone power in the world. The missiles didn't just destroy the military infrastructure. Scores of soldiers stationed at these bases also vanished into thin air, though Israel's official line remained notably silent, preferring downplay over transparency to avoid further embarrassment and humiliation. A journalist who spoke to eyewitnesses there said that the Nevatim Air Base, which has served as a launch point for deadly air operations against Gaza and more recently Lebanon and is located deep inside the Negev Desert, said dozens of missiles landed inside the base, inflicting heavy damage. The attack brought the base
to a grinding halt and resulted in scores of military fatalities. The regime, however, refused to publicly acknowledge it. The journalists also referred to the missiles that landed in Tel Aviv near the Mossad headquarters, which destroyed a good part of the city block, resulting in both human and collateral losses. Again, it wasn't made public. Cars were entirely destroyed, debris covered everything in a 200-foot radius, and the missile crater, which was at least 50 feet wide, was filled in and covered with dirt almost immediately by Israeli authorities, which underscores how embarrassing this was for Israel, which boasts often about the efficiency of its billion-dollar missile defense systems, the journalist said. Just weeks later, on October 18, the Lebanese Hezbollah resistance movement delivered a less subtle but strong message, this time with a drone dining room delivery straight to the Golani Brigade's reconnaissance unit in the occupied city of Haifa. Israeli media initially hesitated before confirming 5 soldier deaths. However, as sources under the cloak of anonymity later revealed, the real number was much higher, buried under layers of secrecy and silence that have come to characterize the Zionist military's standard operating procedure. Recent ground battles between the Zionist regime military and Hezbollah resistance fighters in southern Lebanon have evidently driven Israeli forces to the breaking point, with eyewitnesses' accounts suggesting Israeli fatalities in the hundreds, as well as destruction of Merkava tanks, military bulldozers, armored vehicles, troop carriers, as well as Hermes 450 drones. The Zionist regime in Tel Aviv, however, trickles out only a fraction of these grim numbers, counting soldiers in tens instead of hundreds to soften the blow to the morale of settlers who continue to live in fear. Recently, an Israeli regime army spokesperson reluctantly announced the deaths of an officer and 3 soldiers from Battalion 8207 Alon Brigade during the ground battles in southern Lebanon with Hezbollah under the permitted to publish clause. So, the publication of such content must fit these ambitious clauses. In Gaza, the death toll among Palestinians has tragically surpassed 43,000, most of them women and children, after 1 year of the genocidal aggression that began on October 7, 2023. Yet, the resilience and resolve of fighters from Al-Qassam Brigades, Al-Quds Brigades, and others shines through. Daily bulletins from these groups paint a picture of complex operations that continue to exact a toll on regime forces, employing a repertoire that includes Qassam Ghul rifles, Al-Yassin 105 shells, Shuat explosive devices, and Thaqi barrel bombs, even the sticks that martyr Yahya Sinwar immortalized. But we hardly hear anything from the Zionist regime military about the number of fatalities in these operations. They remain tight-lipped about the losses while bragging about their own genocidal crimes. Iran openly acknowledged the martyrdom of 4 soldiers following Israeli regime strikes on its cities recently. Neither Iran nor the axis of resistance spanning Lebanon, Palestine, Yemen and Iraq covers up its losses. Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon and Ansarullah in Yemen honor those who are martyred in the struggle against the Zionist regime and its Western patrons. These fighters die for a cause greater than personal ambition. Be it Hezbollah leader Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, IRGC commander Abbas Nil Furushan, or Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, these men fought on the front lines and embraced martyrdom. They yearned for it and were prepared for it. As leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei aptly observed in his remarks recently, Zionists do not know Iran. the youth of Iran, the Iranian nation, and they have not yet properly understood the power, capability, ingenuity, and will of the Iranian nation.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Hezbollah says over 95 Israeli troops have been killed and 42 Merkava tanks destroyed since the regime launched its ground aggression against Lebanon. The death toll from Israeli genocide in Gaza tops 43,200 as the regime's unrelenting strikes kill more Palestinians across the blockaded territory. Also coming up, Iran strongly condemns the closure of its consulates in Germany as unjustified and irrational, holding the German government responsible for its consequences. Welcome. The Hezbollah resistance movement says over 95 Israeli officers and soldiers have been killed and 900 others wounded since the regime started its ground invasion against Lebanon. The movement said during the past 45 days it has destroyed a large number of Israel's military vehicles, including 42 Merkava tanks. Resistance fighters have also downed three Hermes 450 and two Hermes 900 drones. This says Hezbollah continued to hit more Israeli targets in fresh retaliatory operations across the occupied territories. It launched rocket attacks on several Israeli military sites, including the Ramin barracks and a warehouse east of Akka, while targeting the settlements of Carmel, Metula, and Kriot. Several gathering points of the regime soldiers were also directly hit with Hezbollah's rockets. The Israeli military presses ahead with this aggression against Lebanon, leaving behind a trail of death and destruction across the country. In one of their latest attacks, Israeli warplanes struck Al-Hawush area near Tyre. destroying a number of buildings. In southern town of Zefta, an Israeli air raid targeted an ambulance, killing a paramedic. Israeli warplanes also struck eastern Lebanon's main city of Baalbek and southern city of Tyre, killing several people, injuring others more. That after the regime issued evacuation orders for both areas, Lebanon's Prime Minister Najib Mikati condemned the Israeli regime's evacuation warnings for entire areas as an additional war crime. He also called for intensified pressure on the regime to stop its aggression. More than 1 year of Israeli aggression against Lebanon has claimed the lives of over 2,800 civilians so far.